National Public Radio presents A Question of Place, Bertrand Russell, A Portrait in Sound.
The square of the sum of two numbers is equal to the sum of their squares increased by twice their product.
The square of the sum of two numbers is equal to the square...
No, you've got it wrong. Did you listen to what I said?
Yes.
Bertie, just repeat it.
Before I began the study of geometry, somebody had told me that it proves things. This caused me to feel delight when my brother said he could teach it to me. He began at the beginning with the definitions. These I accepted readily enough. But next he came to the axioms.
Definitions. Now we come to the axioms.
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 Now these can't be proved, but they have to be assumed before the rest can be proved.
At these words, my hopes crumbled. I'd thought it would be wonderful to find something that one could prove. And then it turned out that this could only be done by means of assumptions of which there was no proof.
But why should I admit these things if they can't be proved?
Bertrand Russell, learning geometry in 1883.
I have throughout my philosophical career had only one constant preoccupation, to discover how much we can be said to know and with what degree of certainty or doubtfulness. From the outset, I wished to persuade myself that something could be known in pure mathematics, if not elsewhere.
Russell's life coincides with an era in the history of philosophy that can be defined in any of three almost equivalent ways. Philosophy, since John Stuart Mill, or the past 100 years of philosophy, or, most significantly, the age of Russell.
These words, written by the American philosopher W.V. Quine, summed up Russell's career.
His life was as broad as it was long. Off at one edge of Russell's broad spectrum, he was a logic-chopping technician, a mathematician's philosopher, and a philosopher's mathematician. At the other edge of his spectrum, he was a social reformer, advocating revision of the family and of sexual mores, and was even communicating with the world's political leaders, doing what he could to decide the fate of the empire.
Russell's brother-in-law, Logan Pearsall Smith, wrote at the turn of the century,
"He is becoming quite a public man. It seems like using a razor to chop wood, but such people are necessary to the state. He is conscientious, public-spirited, and likes excitement. So I suppose he will always be popping out of his cloister into the world."
I think all the great religions of the world, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, and communism, both untrue and harmful. It is evident, as a matter of logic, that since they disagree, not more than one of them can be true.
What is to be said of colleges and universities which hold up before our youth as a responsible teacher of philosophy a man who is a recognized propagandist against both religion and morality, and who specifically defends adultery?
His works are lecherous, libidinous, lustful, venerous, erotomaniac, aphrodisiac, irreverent, narrow-minded, untruthful, and bereft of moral fiber.
Opinions that are held with passion are always those for which no good ground exists. Indeed, the passion is the measure of the holder's lack of rational conviction.
Bertrand Russell was born in 1872, the Victorian age. He died in 1970, the atomic age. His work in philosophy dominated his century. Although his ideas may seem old-fashioned to today's philosophers, it was Russell who attracted many of them to the study of philosophy.
What is the smallest number of simple, undefined things at the start, and the smallest number of undemonstrated premises out of which you can define the things that need to be defined and prove the things that need to be proved?
For all that contemporary philosophers owe to him, Russell's conception of philosophy is old-fashioned. He makes the now unfashionable assumption that all our beliefs are in need of philosophical justification.
The words of philosopher A.J. Ayer. But W.V. Quine wrote,
"In the age of Russell, philosophy itself has gone the way that each of us has gone who was lured to philosophy by Russell's logic."
Russell believed in reason, and he demanded that every belief and rule of conduct pass the test of reason. The most intense human suffering, he thought, is due to the failures of rationality. He argued logically against illogical attitudes. Fear of an angry God, guilt about sexual pleasure. In fact, Russell said, there is no good reason for believing in God at all. Nor is there a good reason for waging war in an age of atomic weapons. His views on God, sex, and war made him notorious.
A man who was a recognized propagandist against both religion and morality, and who specifically defends adultery.
Like his ideals, his personality was sometimes puzzling and offensive. To some of his contemporaries, he seemed a glittering, heartless, logical machine. T.S. Eliot, who had been a philosophy student of Russell's, chronicled his 1914 visit to Harvard in the poem, Mr. Apollinax.
When Mr. Apollinax visited the United States, his laughter tinkled among the teacups. I heard the beat of centaur's hoofs over the hard turf as his dry and passionate talk devoured the afternoon.
He is a charming man.
But after all, what did he mean?
His pointed ears.
He must be unbalanced.
There was something he said that I might have challenged.
Eliot was not the only writer to be fascinated by Russell. After their brief and intense friendship founded, D.H. Lawrence put Russell into his book Women in Love as Sir Joshua Matheson.
A learned, dry baronet of 50 who was always making witticisms and laughing at them heartily in a harsh, hoarse laugh. He talked in a harsh yet rather mincing voice, endlessly, endlessly, always with a strong mentality working, always interesting, and yet always known, everything he said known beforehand, however novel it was, and clever.
Russell's wit was often dry. For instance, this puzzle about the non-existent present king of France.
Either the present king of France is bold, or the present king of France is not bold, must be true. Yet, if we enumerated the things that are bold, and then the things that are not bold, we should not find the present king of France in either list. Hegelians, who love a synthesis, will probably conclude that he wears a wig.
He solved the philosophical problem beneath this conundrum with his theory of descriptions. Russell was always rational, always logical. He was possessed with one passion, to find out what human beings can know with certainty. Yet at the end of his last major book on the subject, Human Knowledge, he wrote dispassionately when another man might have despaired.
All human knowledge is uncertain, inexact, and partial.
The voice of the logician. But Russell had another voice as well. In 1961, he used it to protest nuclear war.
This idea of weapons of mass extermination is utterly and absolutely horrible. And it's a thing which no man with one spark of humanity can tolerate. And I will not pretend to obey a government which is organizing the massacre of the whole of mankind. We cannot obey these murderers. They are wicked and abominable. They are the wickedest people that ever lived in the history of man, and it is our duty to do what we can.
How can we explain these two voices? That of the man of conviction and that of the logician.
Opinions that are held with passion are always those for which no good ground exists. Indeed, the passion is the measure of the holder's lack of rational conviction.
He is a charming man.
But after all, what did he mean?
His pointed ears.
He must be unbalanced.
From his earliest days, Russell's mental and emotional life developed unevenly.
My parents died before I can remember, and I was brought up by my grandparents. My grandfather had been prime minister. Although there were 8 servants, food was always of Spartan simplicity, cold baths all the year round. My grandmother never allowed herself to sit in a comfortable chair until the evening.
Nervous affections. Some people, I do believe, have none but nervous affections, thought Lady Frances. Let me thank you, madam, said Angelina. I am perfectly in my senses now, I can assure you.
Lady Russell was a woman of strong views, more radical than her husband's when he was prime minister in the mid-19th century. His cabinet had dreaded her influence on him. They called her Deadly Nightshade. When the 4-year-old Bertie came to live with her after his parents' death, she decided to raise him to be independent and upright. She read Mariah Edgeworth's moral tales to him in the long, quiet evenings.
As for our heroine, under the friendly and judicious care of Lady Frances Somerset, she acquired that which is more useful to the possessor than genius, good sense. Instead of rambling over the world in search of an unknown friend, she attached herself to those of whose worth she received proofs more convincing than a letter of 3 folio sheets covered with sentimental nonsense. In short, we have now, in the name of Angelina Warwick, the pleasure to assure all those whom it may concern that it is possible for a young lady of 16 to cure herself of the affectation of sensibility and the folly of romance.
I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, lying awake, thinking how dreadful it would be when my grandmother was dead. After she did, in fact, die, which was after I was married, I didn't mind at all. But in retrospect, as I've grown older, I have realized more and more the importance she had in molding my outlook on life. Her fearlessness, her public spirit, her contempt for convention, and her indifference to the opinion of the majority have always seemed good to me and have impressed themselves upon me as worthy of imitation. She gave me a Bible with her favorite texts written on the flyleaf.
Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil.
Russell was a solitary child, and he became a solitary man. Throughout his life, he was often to be found in a crowd, yet always alone. He inherited his family's strong sense of public duty, and he pursued a public career that consisted mainly of supporting unpopular causes. He first stepped into public politics in 1907, while he was still immersed in his work as a philosopher at Cambridge. He stood for Parliament on a platform of votes for women. Women's suffrage was a controversial campaign issue that led to real violence in the early years of the century. Women activists went on hunger strikes, demonstrated in the streets, and even blew up postal boxes. Russell lost the election. He returned his full attention to his work with Alfred North Whitehead, writing Principia Mathematica.
The years from 1902 to 1910 were very painful to me. Every morning I would sit down before a blank sheet of paper. Throughout the day, with a brief interval for lunch, I'd stare at the blank sheet. Often when evening came, it was still blank. It seemed quite likely that the whole of the rest of my life might be consumed in looking at that blank sheet of paper. Then, in the spring of 1905, I discovered my theory of descriptions. In 1906, I discovered the theory of types. After this, it only remained to write them both out. I worked at it from 10 to 12 hours a day for about 8 months in the year, from 1907 to 1910. The manuscript became more and more vast, and every time that I went out for a walk, I used to be afraid that the house would catch fire and the manuscript get burned up. When we finally took it to the university press, it was so large that we had to hire an old four-wheeler for the purpose.
Principia Mathematica was Russell's greatest achievement in philosophy. In it, he tried to resolve the youthful despair that had assailed him when his brother taught him that some things have to be assumed before anything else can be proved.
Why should I admit these things if they can't be proved?
Even in as abstruse a field as the philosophy of mathematics, Russell provoked controversy. Karl Popper wrote,
"The demand raised by many philosophers that we should start with no assumptions whatever and never assume anything without sufficient reason is inconsistent. For it itself rests on the truly colossal assumption that it is possible to start without assumptions and still obtain results that are worthwhile."
Russell tried to make as few assumptions as possible. Using Occam's razor, he cut out all the unnecessary elements in the statement of a philosophical idea.
"What is the smallest number of simple, undefined things at the start, and the smallest number of undemonstrated premises out of which you can define the things that need to be defined and prove the things that need to be proved?"
Part of Russell's problem was solved for him by the mathematician Peano, who had set out pure mathematics as a system that could be deduced from 5 axioms containing only 3 undefined terms, zero, number, and successor. Russell's aim was to deduce the axioms themselves from logical laws and to define the 3 words in purely logical terms. His most famous analysis of mathematics into logic, his definition of number, is full of the highly technical language of the mathematical philosopher.
Number is a way of bringing together certain collections that have a given number of terms. It is simpler logically to find out whether 2 collections have the same number of terms than to define what the number is. Now, 2 classes may be called similar when there is a one-to-one relation which correlates the members of 1 class each with 1 member of the other class, in the same manner in which the relation of marriage correlates husbands with wives. Accordingly,
all collections with the same number of members have in common a number. The number 2 is the common characteristic of all pairs. The number 3 is the common characteristic of all trios. Twins and triplets may have almost nothing in common with other twins and triplets, but they do share the distinguishing numbers, 2 and 3.
Accordingly, the number of a class is the class of all those classes that are similar to it.
Peano had shown that all pure mathematics was about numbers. Russell showed that numbers were classes of a certain kind. He argued that class is a logical notion, and that truths about classes are logical truths.
Arithmetic and pure mathematics generally is nothing but a prolongation of deductive logic.
During Russell's protracted labor on Principia Mathematica, the world had gone on and gone to war. Russell was an adamant pacifist.
"I hardly supposed that much good would come of opposing the war, but I felt that for the honor of human nature, those who were not swept off their feet should show that they stood firm."
He wrote letters to editors.
"All this madness, all this rage, all this flaming death of our civilization and our hopes has been brought about because a set of official gentlemen living luxurious lives, mostly stupid and all without imagination or heart, have chosen that it should occur, rather than that any one of them should suffer some infinitesimal rebuff to his country's pride."
At first, Russell's opinion was widely shared. Even J.J. Thompson, who a short time later would expel Russell from his Cambridge teaching position, signed this protest against the war with Germany.
We consider ourselves justified in protesting against being drawn into the struggle with a nation so near akin to our own and with whom we have so much in common.
Russell continued his active social life. Once again, his path crossed that of the poet T.S. Eliot.
I became great friends with Eliot and his wife. They were desperately poor, and I held some debentures nominally worth £3,000 in an engineering firm, which during the war naturally took to making munitions. I was much puzzled in my conscience as to what to do with these debentures, and at last I gave them to Eliot. Years afterwards, when the war was finished and he was no longer poor, he gave them back to me.
To Russell, the war seemed madness.
After seeing troop trains departing from Waterloo, I used to have strange visions of London as a place of unreality. I used in imagination to see the bridges collapse and sink, and the whole great city vanish in a morning mist. Its inhabitants began to seem like hallucinations. I spoke of this to Eliot.
Unreal city. Under the brown fog of winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine.
As British casualties mounted, opinion shifted. Neutrality and pacifism became intolerable to the public.
We watched you playing cricket and every kind of game. But football, golf, and polo, you men have made your name. But now your country calls you to play your part in war. And no matter what befalls you, we shall love you all the more. So come and join the forces as your fathers did before. Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go. For your king and your country both need you so. We shall want you and miss you, but with all our might and main, we shall cheer you, thank you, kiss you when you come back again.
Russell found himself isolated even from his former allies in all sorts of progressive causes.
H.G. Wells writes that he is enthusiastic for this war. Shaw favors him. Secretaries of peacetime societies welcome it. Vegetarians and anti-vivisectionists support it to a man. Hardly anyone seems to remember common humanity, that war is a mad horror, and that deliberately to cause the deaths of thousands of men like ourselves is so ghastly that hardly anything can justify it.
Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil.
In 1916, Russell wrote a leaflet protesting the imprisonment of a conscientious objector. He was fined £100. 2 years later, he spent 6 months in prison for remarking in an obscure periodical that American troops might be used as strikebreakers in Britain. While he was in prison, he wrote a brilliant popularization of his philosophy of mathematics. And he was out in time for the armistice.
The crowd rejoiced, and I also rejoiced, but I remained as solitary as before.
The war years were a watershed for Russell. His 98 years were less than half gone, yet it seemed a time of endings. He had already published his greatest philosophical work. He had been to prison. He had lost his post at Cambridge. Briefly reinstated, he felt compelled to resign again lest there be yet another scandal. His first marriage, long a mere formality, would soon end in divorce. Meanwhile, Russell had drifted in and out of affairs with a series of women. His attitude toward his work became as peripatetic as his approach to women.
I foresee a rather delightful career as a freelance philosopher, like Abelard.
The freelance philosopher traveled to Russia with an official Labour Party delegation in 1920, expecting to find a Bolshevist workers' paradise. The communist anthem, the Internationale, greeted Russell's party everywhere. At one reception, it was played 17 times. Russell slipped away whenever he could to see how ordinary people lived. He found most of them living in poverty, under the watch of a ruthless police force retained from Tsarist days.
Cruelty, poverty, suspicion, persecution formed the very air we breathed. Our conversations were continually spied upon. In the middle of the night, one would hear shots and know the idealists were being killed in prison. In Petrograd, four scarecrows came to see me, dressed in rags, with a fortnight's beard, filthy nails, and tangled hair. They were the four most eminent poets of Russia. I felt that everything that I valued in human life was being destroyed in the interests of a glib and narrow philosophy, and that in the process, untold misery was being inflicted upon many millions of people. I was infinitely unhappy in that atmosphere, stifled by its own utilitarianism, its indifference to love and beauty, and the life of impulse.
Unlike other early supporters of communism, Russell returned from Russia torn by doubts. He saw through deceptions that more partisan visitors chose not to see at all. Once more, he was thrown back on his solitary stand apart from the crowd.
Throughout my life, I have longed to feel that oneness with large bodies of human beings that is experienced by the members of enthusiastic crowds. The longing has often been strong enough to lead me into self-deception. I have imagined myself in turn a liberal or a socialist or a pacifist, but I have never been any of these things in a profound sense. Always the skeptical intellect, when I have most wished it silent, has whispered doubts to me.
One matter, however a strictly personal one, moved toward certainty and away from doubt.
The desire for children had been growing stronger and stronger within me until at last it had become a consuming passion.
His first wife had been unable to have children. Meeting with a young woman he had known a few years earlier, Russell was astonished to hear her say that her greatest desire in life was to become a mother. Dora Black, who was to become Russell's second wife, accompanied him in 1921 on a year's visit to China. The journey was memorable mainly because Russell nearly died of pneumonia in Peking. In fact, he was reported dead. His brother Frank refused to believe it.
The whole thing's nonsense. Bertie wouldn't die in China without telling me.
The German doctor who saved Russell reproached him for irreverence during his delirium.
So long as you were too weak to speak, you behaved like a true philosopher. But every time you came to yourself, you made a joke.
Nothing the matter with me. Never felt better in my life. Dora, you'd better buy yourself a birthday present from me now, in case I snuff out. If you run out of money, just put a notice in the paper, Russell dead. Money needed to bury the old dog.
Awaited the outcome of Russell's illness with mixed feelings. The Russian community in Peking sent him champagne and whipped cream with the message that he would be needed for the revolution. They had not kept up with his views on Russia. The Chinese flatteringly offered to bury him by the Western Lake with the ancient poets and scholars. Christian missionaries, scandalized by Russell's atheism, almost hoped he would die. But he didn't. In fact, he began to live with new relish. His recovery was speeded by the news that Dora Black was pregnant with his first child.
When I discovered that I was not only to survive myself, but to have a child, I became completely indifferent to the circumstances of convalescence. The main trouble had been double pneumonia, but in addition to that, I had heart disease, kidney disease, dysentery, and phlebitis. None of these prevented me from feeling perfectly happy. Lying in my bed, feeling that I was not going to die, was surprisingly delightful. I'd always imagined until then that I was fundamentally pessimistic and did not greatly value being alive. I discovered that life was infinitely sweet to me. Rain in Peking is rare, but during my convalescence there came heavy rains, bringing the delicious smell of damp earth through the window. I used to think how dreadful it would have been to have never smelled that smell again. I had the same feeling about the light of the sun and the sound of the wind. Just outside my windows, some very beautiful acacia trees came into blossom at the first moment when I was well enough to enjoy them. I've known ever since that at bottom, I am glad to be alive. Most people, no doubt, always know this, but I did not.